I was a little, excuse me, I was a little slow in catching on, to tell the truth. In the spring of 1964, Peter, Paul, and Mary did a concert at Marshall, on the Marshall University campus, where I was a freshman at that time, and I knew who they were well enough to want to see them, so I did. Before they sang Blowin' in the Wind, Peter Yarrow stepped up to the mic and said something like, "This song is written by one of the more outstanding young poets and songwriters of our day, Bob Dylan." About half the audience applauded at the mention of the name. The other half, which included me, sat there wondering, "So who's Bob Dylan?" About that same rough same period of time, on a Sunday evening, I walked into my dorm after attending the evening service at a local Baptist church in Huntington, West Virginia, and I saw the lounge was packed with all eyes on the black and white television set over in one corner. I managed to get close enough to see what was going on and saw the Beatles make their first United States appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. I wondered what all the fuss was about. Wondered what it was with the long hair. Something about it didn't seem quite right. And I went up to my room. What I'm saying is the 60s kind of got underway without me. Or they just didn't penetrate all that far into the world where I was living, both geographically and psychically, as they got underway. Whatever the case, I managed to play enough catch-up ball in the years that followed, through my years in college, through theological school, and into my early years in the ministry. I went through that time knowing I was living in and forming my worldview against the backdrop of an amazing and rather crazy time. Culturally and politically speaking, what is generally referred to as the 60s ran from, and Roy spoke to this in those words for reflection, I'd say it ran from 1963 with the Martin Luther King March on Washington and the Kennedy assassination, which happened in the fall of my freshman year of college, ended somewhere in the early 60s with the winding down of the Vietnam War and the whole Watergate episode. However you care to frame it, and those just happen to be my bookends, it was a very tumultuous time in our nation's history, and its legacy and meaning continue to be debated. For some conservative pundits, I'm thinking of George Will in particular, the 60s was the beginning of everything that's gone wrong with America ever since. Mr. Will's never quite gotten over that time, but in fairness, neither have I. My take is just a little different than his. One unattributed quote about that era I recently came across goes, "I don't remember much about the 60s, but the colors were really vivid." I understand what's being said with that. It gave me a good laugh, too, when I first heard it. But really, for me, it's more the other way around. I have some vivid memories of that time. And I shared some of them last Sunday as we recalled the life and legacy of Martin Luther King and what the impact of his ministry was on mine. But, and I'm sorry if I disappoint here, I somehow got through it without ingesting any psychedelic substance that makes colors any more vivid than they actually are. Inhaled a few times, but that was about it. Well, before I get into the impact of some of those days on my life and ministry, I do want to say a bit about a documentary film that was released last summer and that was shown here this past Friday night. Had a nice little gathering over here in the dining room and watched this film called Magic Trip. It's a documentary about a cross-country trip that author King Kesey and a bunch of folks he gathered around himself in La Honda, California, which is about 40 miles south of San Francisco, called the Merry Pranksters. It's about a trip they took across the United States in the summer of 1964 in a psychedelic painted school bus. What really intrigued me about this film, above and beyond its content, was the attention that it garnered nearly 50 years after the events it showed. It just came out last summer and seemed to attract a fair amount of attention. That was one more indication to me that some eras never completely die. Well, as concise as I can make it, here's some of the backstory. By 1964, King Kesey, who grew up in rural Oregon before coming to the San Francisco Bay Area to attend Stanford University, was a 29-year-old author with two bestsellers already to his name. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Sometimes a Great Notion. While he was at Stanford, he volunteered to be a subject as a way of making some extra cash for some experiments the Defense Department was doing with a drug. They wanted to see what the effects of it might be, maybe how they could use it on enemies for various purposes. The drug, of course, was LSD, and Kesey was quite taken with it. He liked the vivid colors. Thought some of his friends and associates just might like him too. Well, in the summer of 1963, Cuckoo's Nest opened as a play on Broadway, and Kirk Douglas played the lead role of Randall Patrick McMurphy III. And Kesey was invited, of course, to come for the opening. Remember, he's 29 years old now. He learned that come the fall, well, actually, he was 28 in 63. He learned that come the following summer of 64, New York would be hosting a World's Fair out in Flushing Meadow. So he thought it would be fun for him and a few friends to drive across America in a station wagon and go to the fair. He went back to La Honda and started talking up the idea with his tribe of pranksters he had there. And by the following summer, what was going to be a station wagon ride with a few friends had morphed into a bunch of very bright and rather crazy people who took alternate names like Zonker, Generally Famished, Stark Naked, and Speed Limit, to name a few. They piled into a vividly painted school bus with a bunch of film equipment that few of them knew how to use very well, and set out. Driving the bus was Neil Cassady, who had been the prototype for Jack Kerouac's Dean Moriarty in On the Road. After a few halting attempts to edit the footage that was shot on that trip, they ended up in Kesey's farm in Oregon for decades until he died in 2001. And then more recently, and with Kesey's son's permission, the footage was used to make this film Magic Trip. Well, I can't even begin to reconstruct that whole film in a sermon here. As I say, some of you saw it a few days ago. If you've read Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, then you know what it's about, sort of. Reflective of what I said at the outset, I think back, there was no way in the summer of 1964 you could have ever gotten me on that bus. A few years later, maybe. Maybe just for a quick ride around the block or something. But given my penchant for seeking out metaphors, and with the reflective distance a film of nearly 50 years after its event offers, I see that bus working its way across America in the summer of 64, working its way across and back, as an apt metaphor for an encapsulated counterculture swimming through the mainstream culture of its time, like a straw in the wind of all that was to come. There are some simultaneously funny and not so funny episodes in this thing. At one point, the pranksters pull into the suburban home of author Larry McMurtry. He and Kesey had known each other from a writing seminar at Stanford a few years earlier, and McMurtry would later become one of America's most prolific novelists with The Last Picture Show, Terms of Endearment, The Whole Lonesome Dove narratives, to name but a few. He would later, just recently, won an Academy Award for doing the screenplay for Brokeback Mountain. I'll get this, okay. But in 1964, Larry McMurtry was this young, he was only 28 himself, he was this young, kind of nerdy-looking English teacher with a wife and a kid living in a Houston suburb. He just began his literary career. He had a novel or two published. So there he is, and he gets descended upon by a bunch of lunatics. Nice enough lunatics, to be sure. Kind of scary to the neighbors, though. During their stay with McMurtry, though, one of the pranksters had some kind of a psychotic break. She got taken to a mental ward and eventually had to go back to San Francisco. Then there's the stop at Lake Pontchartrain outside of New Orleans, where they all decide to go swimming at a beach. It's not until they've piled out of the bus and are in the water that they realize they're the only white people there. None of them had ever been in the Deep South. And even in 1964, in that locale, blacks and whites could not swim in the same place. You spent most of your life in the Bay Area, you didn't quite connect with that. The pranksters were not exactly asked to leave, but they knew it was probably best that they not be there, so it was back in the bus and off again. They do make it to New York. They briefly take in the World's Fair. The scene I most fixed on in this part of the film is where Neil Cassady goes out to Long Island to bring his old buddy of the roads, who's living out there, Jack Kerouac, to a Park Avenue apartment where the pranksters are partying. One of the pranksters had a connection with an upscale New Yorker who, not quite knowing what he was in for, let him stay at his Park Avenue place. Well, the pranksters saw Kerouac as their spiritual godfather. On the road was their Bible, and to top it all off, here they had Neil Cassady, Kerouac's Dean Moriarty, driving them across the USA. But what you get in that Park Avenue party scene is a bewildered Kerouac who never quite let go of his Lowell and Roman Catholic roots, just kind of looking around at all that's going on around him, wondering what on earth he'd given rise to. The look on Jack's face says, "You mean I'm responsible for all this? Are you kidding me?" Well, that's about as much as I'm going to do with the film here. For all of its nuttiness and some of its occasional downsides, it had a certain kind of joyful innocence about it. The pranksters were doing just that, being prankful. They were playful revolutionaries. They weren't trying to overthrow the established order so much as they were making fun of it, refusing to play by its rules or take it seriously. They questioned authority largely by ignoring it. Some very hilarious scenes in that movie where they get stopped by the police a couple of times and they all jump out with the movie cameras like they're filming a movie, and Neil Cassady goes on one of his long talks, and the police finally just don't know what to do with them, so they just tell them to get back on the bus and keep going, which is what they did. So they questioned authority largely by ignoring it. Up to a point, they got away with it. They were also a part of a larger mosaic of music and artistic expression that was just beginning to shake the cultural foundations of their society. And those cultural shakeups went hand in hand with some of the political upheavals of the time, including the civil rights movement, the opposition to the Vietnam War, the women's movement, and then a little later, the push for gay lesbian rights. All of those things came out of that era, and you think what the country would have been like if that had not taken place at the time it did. As for me, I was preparing for the ministry while all this was going on, which proved to be a trip of its own. And in its own way, it was also revolutionary. I wasn't on Kesey's bus, but I had my own journey going. My personal foundations came in for their share of being shaken, and what had been sources of personal authority for me came to be questioned. This is hardly an unusual process for a lot of young people as they move into adulthood. It just happened for me at an unusual time. The biggest challenge for me, the biggest challenge or shakeup, and I've related this in plenty of other sermons, was my religious worldview. Few college classes in philosophy of religion and some that took an academic approach to biblical studies that served to uproot the near fundamentalism in which I've been raised. And I learned it was possible to question some of your deepest held beliefs and your world will not fall apart. I also learned that questioning authority did not necessarily mean rejecting authority. It just means you have the freedom to decide what is going to be authoritative in your life. Now, fortunately, there were some very good liberal-minded campus ministers who helped me through my struggles of the spirit, my struggles of belief. I had entered college with the idea of becoming a minister, but the experience just in my college days caused me to decide that ministry was really about opening minds up. It was really about encouraging spiritual growth and not about indoctrination or imposing beliefs or dogma. And so with that in mind, I chose to attend a liberal Christian seminary. I moved north and I prepared to be a university campus minister because I was so appreciative of what the campus ministers at Marshall had done for me. In this same vein, and as I've shared in other sermons, I came to see how religion could be a force for justice and peace in the world. It did not have to be a part of the forces of reaction, as unfortunately it often is. I covered some of that last Sunday in speaking of how my witnessing Dr. King's ministry was so influential as I prepared for the ministry myself. And as I spoke to last fall, one of my more vivid memories of this era was in the fall of 1969 when I spent an evening along with several other seminarians at Cornell University, where Dan Berrigan was a chaplain. We spent an evening with Father Berrigan shortly before he went to jail for some of his civil disobedience activities in protest of the Vietnam War. And he sat there and he talked about how he connected his Jesuit teachings with his action. Here again, I understood that questioning authority is not about nihilism or anarchy, but it rather about choosing the ultimate authority that you're going to live by and then accepting whatever consequences or outcomes come from that. Looping back to college for a moment, I made some good friends from about my sophomore year on with some of the international students. They had an international club there. They also let Americans join, and I started hanging out with them. Became good friends with a fellow a few years older than I was from Kenya. And when it got to where I could have some in-depth conversations with some of these people, I learned, at least to some extent, how to view the world through something other than a strictly American-centered lens. And while I have never lost my affection for this land of ours, I learned, at least again to some extent anyway, to think about how we are seen beyond our boundaries. That experience was very important for me, clear back in my college days. Indeed, it was right about this time that Bob Dylan, and I did figure out who he was soon enough, came out with a song called With God on Our Side. Some of you probably remember it. It challenges in both subtle and satiric ways the idea that God has somehow granted us most favored nation status. It's amazing, in a way, how a single song can alter one's worldview. And Bob Dylan had a gift for turning out just such songs. Indeed, beyond the religion classes and philosophical debates and political conversations, it was listening to the music, particularly from the latter part of the 60s, that had as much of a challenging and transforming effect upon me as anything else. From Dylan to Phil Oakes's Late Phil Oakes, Tear Down the Walls and I Ain't Marching Anymore, to John Lennon's Imagine, or Paul McCartney's Let It Be, which I had sung at my ordination ceremony into the ministry, to the discovery of Woody Guthrie by the generation of singers who came of age as he was dying. All of this was what raised my consciousness, to use a term from that era. Those were the kinds of things that raised my consciousness at least as much as the 8 years of academia that I made my way through after graduating from high school in 1963. Now, by the time I had entered the ministry in the fall of 71, Woodstock, which I did not make, was already 2 years in the rearview mirror. I left the East for the little town of Greencastle, Indiana, to be the campus minister at DePaul University. By then, I had married a very fine person. At our wedding, I wore a tie with peace symbols all over it. I updated that tie today. This is a Jerry Garcia tie here. That's the, yeah. As things turned out, this very fine person and I were just not too bent to be married to each other, but that's the way it happens sometimes. I've been ordained as a liberal Christian, and I ran a Protestant interfaith campus ministry at DePaul for a while. But my spiritual journey continued to be one of probing, exploring, and questioning. Explorations that in time took me to the Unitarian Universalist ministry some 7-8 years after I was initially ordained, and where I've been ever since. And I have stayed with the UU ministry mainly because it offers me an arena where my own journey of spirit and exploration can keep going without the boundaries or limitations of any kind of dogma. And 3/4 of my time in the UU ministry has been with this congregation from this pulpit. And next Sunday I will share how my being with you in this congregation for nearly 1/4 century, I'll share some thoughts on how that has also shaped my journey of ministry. You got to come back next week for that one. But before concluding, I want to do a revisit of Magic Trip and the note on which it ends. But I'm going to preface it with a few observations first. In most any culture, a time comes when it goes through certain upheavals, when its assumptions and values and mores and its supposedly fixed foundations become challenged and even thrown up for grabs. If this didn't happen from time to time in the life of a culture, it would become static and it would atrophy. Back to what I said earlier, think about where we'd be if you hadn't had the civil rights movement or the women's movements, or just questioning the automatic assumption that if the powers that be choose to go to war, that's where we should go. All that came out of that of that era. And as I said, the push for gay lesbian affirmation rights came shortly thereafter. If these kinds of things didn't happen from time to time in the life of a culture, the culture would become static and it would atrophy. And those who become the foundation shakers don't always completely know what they're doing. They're just driven, it seems, to act in ways counter to the norm. And the pranksters, from a cultural point of view, played that countercultural role of being out there on the edge. And some of the ways in which they took that role were healthy and even fun. Other ways, of course, not so much. Kesey would later refer to them and himself as divine losers. And I love that phrase. I think it means, not that I can get completely inside Kesey's head when he said it, but I think it means you do what you feel you're inspired to do, you do what you feel is the right thing to do, and you don't worry so much about winning or losing. You just do it. Here's another piece. Even as a culture has its times of upheaval and stirring the pot, at some point it has to coalesce again, taking the best of its transformations with it, and then move along. That's what I see happening in this country in the post-60s era. And the same goes for individual lives. We have our times of upheaval, and then we need to coalesce and move along. I went through a lot of religious and spiritual upheaval during the 60s and early 70s, and then that coalesced around the UU ministry and moved me along. It eventually brought me here. Well, think about that process. I'm going to bring it back to the fates of two pranksters. It's kind of cases in point. A few years after the magic trip and after having to deal with various legal issues related to his drug use, Ken Kesey decided it was time for him to move on. He staged in the Bay Area what he called an acid test graduation, at which he declared that LSD was maybe no longer necessary, maybe no longer even quite advisable for gaining spiritual revelations. He moved back to Oregon, reconstructed his marriage with a woman, Faye, to whom he'd been married since college, and set about raising his family. He even taught a graduate writing seminar at the University of Oregon. In time, he had to put a chain across the entrance to his farm and a sign with the single word "no" on it. It was his message to the itinerant hippies who were seeking him out and thinking it'd be way cool to go hang out with Kesey for a while. Kesey got to the point where he didn't think that was all that way cool himself. He died too early still. He died in 2001 at the age of 67 after surgery for a form of lung cancer he had developed. And in sort of a circle coming around, just this past spring, this past May, his widow Faye married the aforementioned Larry McMurtry. Neil Cassidy fared quite differently. At the age of 42, while walking along a stretch of railroad tracks near San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, he collapsed and died. Even his well-constructed body could only take so much of living on the edge of near continuous and often narcotic-fueled movement. When I first saw this film, Magic Trip, last summer, I saw it at a premiere screening in Santa Cruz, California, and I was there as the guest of two of Neil Cassidy's kids, a son and a daughter, slightly younger than I am, who in recent years have become very good friends of mine. They've long known how their father died. We've talked about it. But it was still quite poignant to sit with John and Jamie in a theater as their father's demise was described. I make no value judgment about any of this, only an observation. We choose the lives we live, and we live with the outcome of our choices. And Neil Cassidy knew that. Well, I got one more story. Get us out of here this morning. Very warm evening last July, I found myself in, of all places, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Did a lot of running around last summer. Santa Cruz, Tulsa. I was there for a 5-day Woody Guthrie Festival that took place in his hometown of Okemah, which is about 50, 60 miles southwest of Tulsa. There was no venue in Tulsa large enough, however, to hold the opening event, which was a concert by David Crosby and Graham Nash, one half of the late 60s, early 70s group of Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Concert took place in this big old cavernous hall called the Kane Auditorium, which is in a funky bohemian section of Tulsa. Even Tulsa has a funky bohemian section, even if it is only about a block long. the duo, Dave Crosby, Graham Nash, did a very good show. They left the stage, and then they came back for their final number. And when they hit just those first five introductory notes to teach your children, I'm telling you, the whole place was on its feet. And by the time they got through the first line, "You who are on the road must have a code that you can live by," they had every voice in the place joining theirs. It seemed like everyone knew every single word. While adding my unlikely voice to all of the others, I took a look around. There were gray heads like me who remembered the song from when Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young first sang it and recorded it in 1969. And then there were kids. I mean kids. Late teens, early 20s, who were still years away from even being a twinkle in their parents' eyes when that song was first released. And they knew it as well as everyone else. And just as I did over 40 years ago, they too need a code they can live by. That whole scene served to let me know there are certain times, there are certain eras that are also timeless. They transcend the events that took place during them and leave an ongoing impact on the culture in which they occurred. And I'm very grateful to have grown up with that kind of backdrop, for such were the 60s in America. I'm guessing we here can sing that song as well as that audience at the Kane Auditorium did. You're going to get the chance to do it too. If you need the words, they're in your order of service. And I want to thank these Tess and all these folks for helping along. Let's wrap it up with Teach Your Children. Let's stand and sing it.